diversity experts talk to discuss ADHD and emotional intensity and emotional dysregulation in adults. Thank you so much for joining us today. This has been phenomenal.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it very much. Thanks for having me, Natalie.
And the previous program was Neurodiversity Expert Speaks with Natalie Tandyway, and as heard Fridays at 2 p.m. It's now 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Ecologic. Coming up, stay tuned.
You don't know what you've got till it's gone. They paid paradise, put up a parking lot.
If they keep on polluting the earth and telling where we're gonna plant our seed, it makes me wanna cry for the children. Makes me wanna cry for Mother Earth. Makes me wanna cry for could know if we listen to the earth.
I ain't blind, don't like what I think I see.
Take it into the streets,
take it up to the streets,
take it into the streets,
no more
take it into the streets,
no more
take it out of the streets.
Take this message to my
okay, anytime. Okay, look like we're experiencing some type of technical difficulties here. I think that we have one of the hosts available. So I'll just leave it over to Donna. You're there?
I am.
Okay, now looking for Ken and Sally, but you can, since this is your program, why don't you take it over until we find the rest of them?
Okay, there was something wrong with the connection that you sent where, hello everybody, there was something wrong with the connection that you sent that it just dropped us.
I don't know. Well, we'll figure it out as we go along, but start the show?
Am I here?
Yay!
Okay.
the gang's all here.
The gang is all here. Glad to hear. Oh, boy. Have we started?
Yes, we're already in the show.
We're talking to our audience.
Okay, every day is Earth Day. I'm Ken Gale.
And Sally Gellert will be joining us, and I'm Donna Stein, and this is Ecologic for November 20th, 2020.
When your air or water are clean, thank an environmentalist. If not, become one. Enough said.
Environmental regulations are often manipulated during trade talks with other nations. Sometimes they are improved and sometimes eroded. Learn how trade negotiations are expected to affect the environment under the new federal administration.
And we'll have our guests introduce themselves so we have voices to go with their names. We'll start with you, Adam.
Okay. My name is Adam Weissman. I, for many years, was the director of Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, which is an organization focused on addressing the impact of U.S. trade policy on the environment, animals, safe, just, and sustainable food, and the human rights of environmental defenders. And I was also an organizer for Trade Justice New York Metro, which is a coalition of public interest, social justice, et cetera, groups in the
great coalition
area. What's that?
A great coalition.
Thank you. Which which all of our hosts made great, all of the hosts of the program today made great contributions to, as well as Trade Justice Alliance, which works, which hosts webinars and provides educational resources for grassroots trade justice organizers around the U.S. and beyond, and that information is available at tradejustice.net, and for Global Justice for Animals and the Environment, gjae.org, or freetradekillsanimals.org.
Hi, Adam. Sally here. Glad to hear you. Glad to get here.
Hillary, are you with us?
Sally, great to hear from you.
I am.
Yeah.
Hey, Hillary, introduce yourself so we have information on you.
Totally. So I'm Hillary Hayden. I'm the executive director at the Washington Fair Trade Coalition in Washington State. But we work with the network of Citizens Trade Campaign coalitions around the country on getting a trade policy that benefits people on the planet.
So trade.
Thank you so much for...
Yeah. And, go ahead, Sally.
Yeah, no, I was just saying that trade seems to be an esoteric issue for a lot of people. It seems complicated, not related to everyday life. So what are the environmental implications of international trade regulations? Adam?
Hillary?
When we're in the studio, it's so much easier to point to who's going to talk next. So,
yeah, I'm just to clarify, I'm going to be helping ask questions more so than answering them. So,
got it.
Okay, so I should take the question.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Awesome. So, yeah, no. So there's all kinds of pieces of environmental policy that play into trade policy. Our trade policy typically provides corporations with a whole host of tools that they can use to challenge new climate regulations. Numerous free trade agreements and the WTO have investor-state dispute settlement, which maybe folks are familiar with. It's literally a system where – it's literally exactly what it says. It's where investors, companies have a chance to challenge governments over new regulations that might keep them from making money. This is like anti-mining laws in El Salvador, clean air rules in Peru, Chevron in Ecuador, and even like the Obama administration had originally granted the permit for the Keystone Pipeline to a Canadian company. And so when Obama kind of backtracked on wanting the Keystone Pipeline, that Canadian company was allowed to sue under the original NAFTA using investor state dispute settlement to try to get money, basically, for not being able to put that pipeline in anymore. And aside from that sort of regulatory stuff, these like tools that corporations have to deal with regulations, trade agreements are kind of a space where there's a fight going on over whether we'll have a regulatory system that favors the precautionary principle, which the EU largely has. We'll see if the UK follows suit when they go through the Brexit process. But the precautionary principle essentially says, before a good gets on the market, we're going to make sure that it's safe. The U.S. does not have the precautionary principle. When we put a good on the market, it's on a consumer to prove that that product is not safe before it gets removed from the market. So that, I mean, that looks like years and years and years of Roundup use before someone can prove that that's how they got cancer. And then that good gets pulled from the market or certain lawsuits are allowed to proceed. But it's these two different strategies, right? For how we're going to enact regulatory policy that kind of play out in our trade policy. We talk a lot about the way that trade agreements keep people in the dark, the way that we're not given a lot of transparency. While other countries allow citizens to review proposed trade policies before and during our trade negotiations, recent U.S. presidents have chosen to negotiate our trade deals behind closed doors. So there's 600, I think, trade advisors, and most of them are corporate lobbyists instead of labor unions, instead of environmental activists, instead of folks who are actually going to be impacted by these policies. There's executives from fossil fuel and mining industries that are in the background of all of these policies, environmentalists, journalists, and those folks, like I mentioned, that are going to be affected by these trade negotiators' decisions have no right to see any of those texts until trade negotiations have concluded. And at this point, honestly, we watch this play out with the USMCA, but once the text is concluded, it's pretty difficult to make real substantive changes to the agreement.
How come?
I think the only... So the thing is, all of the countries have to agree to whatever the text changes are. And so the more countries you have, the harder it is. Yeah, exactly. So with the USMCA, there's three. With the Trans-Pacific Partnership, there would have been, I think, 11 countries besides the U.S. So it's just difficult to get folks on the same page.
Wow.
They went through, the House went through with the USMCA process. The House went through like a four-month process on trying to get the substantive changes that people wanted. So it's difficult. It's difficult to go through that process.
And USMCA was many people know that Donald Trump campaigned in 2016 as a fierce critic of U.S. trade policy, very critical of NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And USMCA was his administration's NAFTA replacement. Can you tell us about the verdict on USMCA regarding the environment? Did we end up with a better agreement for the planet or really did we not make progress? I know some of the environmental groups had strong criticisms of USMCA, but other groups felt it was at least a step in the right direction.
So yeah, I think that's the tension, right? I think that's always the question with trade policy is whether we're looking at if we made little baby step progress on certain pieces of it, or whether, you know, we got that paradigm shift in thinking in a trade policy. And obviously, we didn't get that paradigm shift in thinking about trade policy from the USMCA. Mm-hmm. But we did manage to get certain individual pieces. So folks in the environmental movement who are happy with the USMCA point to the fact that the precautionary principle is no longer part of regulatory thing. There was a piece of the original NAFTA that forced Canada to send a certain percentage of all of its extractive industries to the United States.
Wow.
So Canada started moving back. I know, it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy to lock something like that into a trade agreement and then not negotiate it again for 25 years.
Wow.
So they had been following this, but they had also been committing to certain things under the Paris Climate Agreement, which they did not pull out of the way that the U.S. did under Donald Trump. And so they were working to meet these Paris Climate Agreement commitments and pull less and less things out of the ground. And we're getting to a point where they could either commit to their Paris Climate Agreement goals, or they could commit to their proportionality rules under the original NAFTA. So for folks in the environmental movement who saw this as a big problem, it's not in the new NAFTA. So some folks are really happy about that. What was that?
That does sound like a step forward.
Yeah, no, that's a... It's a small step forward. I think for folks who wanted a lot more transparency about who was doing the negotiating, we obviously didn't get that. For folks who weren't an environmental activist in the room to help do negotiations or to make suggestions on the text, of course we did not get this. The other thing, like I was mentioning, is with investor-state dispute settlement. An investor-state dispute settlement's future is kind of questioned in the USMCA. So with Canada, there will be no more investor-state dispute settlement. So between the U.S. and Canada, no companies can sue either government over new environmental regulations. And that's good news. It's, I think according to Global Trade Watch, it's like 93% of our investor-state dispute settlement case liability was with Canada. The problem is that with Mexico, it will largely continue. There's some restrictions on how long folks have to spend or companies have to spend in domestic court systems, which is also a good thing, that they would be forced to go through domestic processes first. But there's a whole carve-out for all the oil, gas, mining industry where they can continue to use investor-state dispute settlement completely unabated. And so the other thing, I guess, about ISDS is, like, some of the most egregious uses of this policy, of this thing in our trade policy, are environmental. They are, like, companies that want to do mining or companies that want to be able to pollute, like, with no restrictions, and then don't like being told by trade policy or by a domestic economy that they have to rein back their pollution. So they have this other tool in trade policy to sue through when they don't like those new regulations. So having that carve out in the USMCA for the oil and gas companies is not obviously an environmental win. So I think there are folks who are really torn. Some folks, a lot of the big environmental orgs were really out against it. Some weren't, as you were mentioning. So that was sort of the story of the USMCA is, are we willing to accept tiny incremental changes, or are we looking for this, like, really better vision for trade policy?
Right. So looking at some of the other, aspects of Trump-era trade policy, we had public and contentious negotiations with China. We're now looking at negotiations between the U.S. and the U.K. What would you say going into the Biden era are some of the key environmental questions that we're looking at in continuing with the trade policy, trade issues of the Trump era and priorities looking ahead that we can expect from the Biden administration?
Totally. I think the first thing is we need to be really focused on who the U.S. trade rep candidate is. This is not something a lot of, like, people are paying attention to or necessarily know about, but I think a lot of the major policy initiatives that the Biden administration wants to move forward with are things that will violate our trade policy. And there needs to be someone in that USTR role who can rebuild that working class trust in the Democratic Party, that can work with Biden on figuring out how to do this stuff with trade policy that stands in the way. And so I guess I'll say just quickly, like, Biden has this Build Back Better agenda, and it has all kinds of goals for climate change and for the, like, economic recovery, for infrastructure, COVID-19 stuff. A lot of those plans violate things that are in our trade agreement. And we would say, trade activists would say, rather than trying to cut at the corners of Build Back Better programs into these constraints that trade policies will allow for, the incoming administration should take some executive actions to dismantle those restrictions and put forward a better model for trade that would get rid of those restrictions moving forward in a way that advances this administration's economic and environmental and public health goals. I think the Biden administration really needs to reconvince a lot of folks in the fair trade movement that there's a better vision for trade. Trump really did a good job convincing huge swaths of a working class electorate that he had their backs. You know, a lot of the 2016 election hinged on Rust Belt states that largely went for Obama, I think twice for Obama, and then turned around and voted for Trump instead of Hillary Clinton. But we know, we've been talking for the last 10, 15 minutes now about Trump's failure to produce a real fair trade alternative. And so there's a window here. There's an opening for a Biden administration to step in, win back that fair trade mantle for the Democratic Party. But the other thing to say is that the failure to do something like that would open the door for another Trump-like nationalist in 2024. I think, in general for us, those are the things we would want. We would want to see a U.S. trade rep that's friendly to working people and friendly to these environmental initiatives that we'd like to move forward that currently violate our U.S. trade policy. But then we want to see an attempt to reverse those policies and get all of these, like, public interest build back better programs actually through, Buy America, investments in infrastructure, things like this.
So those trade policies are internal policies that we could change. They're not international agreements that we're stuck with.
So there's certain things that we could do. There's ways that Biden could go about essentially like instituting Buy America, for example. When I talk with environmental folks that like Buy America policy, it's usually because goods aren't traveling so far to get to the place where we're going to use them. But for labor unions, they're pumped for Buy America because it means we're buying things from folks in the U.S. and saying with our dollars, like, we want good labor standards or good supply chains. And so we want Biden to use those. There's ways that he could use executive action to kind of diminish the impact of a Buy America policy. So we're hopeful that he'll use whatever executive action powers he has available to allow his administration to move forward on some of those things.
I gotta cut in here and tell everybody, it is amazing how fast time goes when you're on a short program like this. And this trade is so complicated that and yet simple once you understand it, like anything else. And we really need to have more time, which is why we're going to go to after the program call after this. And at some point or other, it's going to be on our screen, our ecologic.org website.
Ecoradio.org.
Ecoradio.
Ah, yes. It's thank you. If you go to our Facebook page, it's Ecologic, Eco-Logic. Okay, so we're going to continue the discussion after the show. We will send a notice to our email list when it's up. So those of you online, go to www.ecoradio.org and please sign up on our mailing list. And we really thank our guests for today.
Yes, thank you very much,
Hillary
and Adam. Hillary, do you have a website for us?
I do. It's WashingtonFairTrade.org.
Repeat that.
Washington, all spelled out, FairTrade.org.
And for New Yorkers who are interested in getting more involved in this issue, is there a website that you would suggest that New Yorkers?
We don't really have time. That's going to be on ecoradio.org.
Yeah. There's a lot of environmental news on ecoradio.org. So sign up for our mailing list, and when something new is posted, we'll tell you.
Okay. And as you know, we have something that belongs to you. This listener-sponsored radio station is yours. Now we need you to show your responsibility and your love for WBAI Radio and your favorite show, or at least one of them, we hope. That's Ecologic.
You have choices on how you can keep us on the air. You can go to www.givetowbai.org to get any one or more of our terrific premiums by putting Eco-Logic in the search box in the upper right corner.
And we would always like to encourage each of you, our listeners, to become our buddy. Just go to www.givetowbai.org, go to the BAI Buddy page, and on the drop-down box, click on Ecologic and pledge a monthly amount, any amount. Think of what this show is worth to you.
We have our sincere thanks.
And thank you to Engineer Reggie Johnson. I'm Ken Gale.
And I'm Donna Stein. And I'm Donna Stein. See you next Friday at 2:30 p.m. Thank you, Sally Geller, one of our co-hosts.
WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. New guidelines published on the Centers for Disease Control website are recommending that U.S. citizens do not travel during next week's Thanksgiving holiday. The CDC advised against gathering with anyone who has not lived in the same household for at least 14 days, the incubation period for COVID-19 infection. The CDC said anyone who does gather in person should bring their own food and utensils and celebrate outdoors if possible. If celebrating indoors, the CDC recommends opening windows and putting fans in front of open windows to pull fresh air into the room where guests are sitting. It also suggests limiting the number of people near where food is being prepared. The CDC's warning came a day after seven governors, two of them Republicans, published an op-ed in the Washington Post calling for people to stay home this Thanksgiving. Even more governors have tightened restrictions across the U.S. in an effort to stem the spread of the coronavirus. In Pennsylvania, the authorities said anyone traveling to that state would need to be tested before arrival. Rhode Island issued a social gathering limit that bars anyone in the state from spending time in a social setting with anybody from outside of their household. California Governor Gavin Newsom ordered that all counties in the state's purple tier or higher in terms of coronavirus cases enter a partial stay-at-home order, meaning that people may not leave their residences for anything besides essential work between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. Pfizer today said it is moving ahead with its request for emergency use of its COVID-19 vaccine. The request comes after Phase 3 clinical studies showed Pfizer's vaccine to be 90% effective in preventing the disease associated with the coronavirus. Health and other frontline workers could get the vaccine as soon as December. The Labor Department reports 743,000 U.S. workers filed for new unemployment claims last week, a rise of about 30,000 from the previous week, as coronavirus infections hit record highs from coast to coast. This comes as a new study by the Century Foundation found that unless Republican senators follow House Democrats by passing a COVID relief bill, 12 million U.S. workers lose federal unemployment benefits by December 26th. In New York, food banks report they've had to turn away needy families amid unprecedented demand. A Harlem food bank recently handed out 500 turkeys to residents, including Ruth Crawford.
You have to try to relax and think of the better things because it wasn't always like this. But this is getting to people and it's just sad. I mean, you work all the time and then you can't go to work or you can't work from home. So it's not easy.
The hunger relief group Feeding America warns some 54 million U.S. residents currently face food insecurity. The United States is one of a long list of countries that has imported PPE from factories in China, where North Korean women have been working in conditions of modern slavery, according to an investigation by The Guardian. The protective equipment reportedly comes from factories using North Korean labor in the northern Chinese city of Dandong. The women reportedly work 18-hour days.